Welcome to the collection on Audioboom. On this week's show, entrepreneur Jim Mellon.
FTSE 100 leaders coming out and lecturing us on Brexit, those kind of Muppets coming out and telling us that we should vote for to stay in, I give no credence to.
The chairman of UK Oil and Gas, Stephen Sanderson.
New tech study said that there's 124 billion barrels, actually oil in the ground over the Weald area, which is about 1,200 square miles. It looks very encouraging. You probably ask me, well, is it going to be another North Sea?
And value investor Harsha Borralesa.
There's still a lot of uncertainty at the moment, but I think the important thing to remember is that, when people are fearful, get in there and be greedy.
After all the controversy regarding the Google tax a couple of weeks ago, we finally learned from the French what the bill to the Internet Search Engine Group should have been. Not £130 million, but perhaps 10 times that amount. Rip-off Britain was also given publicity by the telecoms regulator Ofcom, who suggested that BT should open up its Openreach broadband service to competition, even though the telecoms giant had hinted that if it can keep Openreach, it would pump £1 billion into improving it. The smart play for Ofcom would be for it to force BT into coughing up £1 billion and then ending its monopoly, followed by sacking itself for being such a poor regulator. Openreach was founded 10 years ago, so it's had plenty of time to get this situation under control. Lloyds Banking announced a statutory profit of £1.6 billion and a £2.1 billion provision for the PPI ripoff, and best of all, a 2p dividend in total to shareholders. Former chairman Sir Victor Blank took the opportunity of defending the Lloyds HBOS shotgun wedding 7 years ago, despite it being one of the worst examples of shareholder abuse in stock market history. Speaking of the stock market, at the third time of asking, LSE and Deutsche Börse looked as though, after a 15-year on-off courtship, they might finally be merging, in the kind of pan-European love fest which would horrify the Brexit brigade. The only thing left to sort out are the beach towels. Okay, gentlemen, let's just start off with the Brexit debate, and we'll start off our own little area of discussion and agreement and disagreement. Jim Mellon, you are an ardent Brexit person, possibly more ardent than Boris Johnson, who's only a new convert to this concept. But what are your main reasons that the UK should leave? Because it is actually quite problematic. We've been in for 40 years, and it's rather difficult to get out now, isn't it?
Well, I'm not that ardent. I don't think it's a life-altering decision. I don't think, we should engage in a civil war over the issue. But what my general view is that the European Union is going to fracture quite soon because of the weaknesses of the Eurozone, and in particular France and Italy, who I believe to be in debt traps that are irretrievable. And as I say, in a nutshell, I think it's better to be in a comfortably appointed boat, lifeboat in the English Channel while the Euro Titanic sinks, and then to reform with a less federalist institution and less members, because at the moment it's very unwieldy, it has a federalist agenda, and there is undoubtedly a high economic cost for the UK to remain in. That cost, by the way, is the equivalent of 350,000 people working full-time all year round, shoveling money across the channel to other people in other countries, just to put it in perspective.
Right, to sort of use your lifeboat analogy, the problem with the UK is that we are in a bit of a fork in the road in terms of if we stay, the Tory party will break in two. And if we leave, then Scotland will leave us because it wants to be part of the EU. So basically, we're damned on both sides at the moment, aren't we?
Well, there is the argument on the Scottish side, but that doesn't mean that you shouldn't vote the right way just because you think the Scots might leave. The latest opinion polls suggest that even if there's another referendum in Scotland as a result of the UK leaving and England voting to leave, but Scotland voting to remain, that the Scots will still vote to remain in the United Kingdom, which is my general sense. But we are confronted with a choice, yes or no. My view is no, but as I said, it's not life-changing. I won't be throwing myself off a bridge if the result is yes. And I would say, as a gambling man, if I was a gambling man, that is, I would say that it's likely that we are going to remain, although the odds are shortening. They're getting narrower on the voting out side. So it's going to be a tight contest, but I think Cameron will edge it because he's got the power of the government and the propaganda machine of the EU behind him, and the inertia aspect of just, you know, the so-called unknown leap into the dark argument will probably mean that we'll end up remaining. But on balance, as an economist, I think it's better if we vote to leave.
You're not going to get this argument on the BBC. You're not going to get this argument via any government channel. You know, the main problem that there is in this campaign is that we don't have a proper, open, free democracy working here. We only have democracy on trivial issues like parking meters and speed cameras.
Well, you're speaking to the converted. I mean, I'm
let's see if there's anybody else converted in this studio. Stephen Sarnason, one of the issues here, which is actually an economic one, I think, which Jim can also speak about, is the collapse of the North Sea. In fact, the two things have collapsed, which I remember from 40 years ago. One is the EU, which from 1975. We've actually gone right round to the other side of the circle there. And the second one, I remember as a nine-year-old kid saying that the North Sea, you know, they found, you know, they're just coming on tap here, you know, by the year 2000 will be self-sufficient and, you know, all the sort of stuff like that. So it was, there were exciting times in the 70s. You are adding a bit more sort of a much needed excitement for people who like oil and gas in the UK. But, you know, can you save, you know, can you save the day? Can you be a significant contributor to our energy needs?
I'll answer that question in a minute, but let's go back to your point before. I think I'm an oil and gas explorer, so I'm in risk and reward. And I don't, at the moment, I can see some of the attractions of the Brexit, but when I look at the uncertainty involved and what the prize is, the prize is very poorly defined at the moment. There's a lot of motherhood and apple pie. So when I look at the reward, if I'm willing to take quite a risk, and I think you know, the markets, the pound has gone down very recently, so the world sees some volatility in an exit. And I think, well, if I could see that there was a huge benefit rather than something that's quite grey, I'd be for it. But at the moment, I think the risk-reward balance tells me that until I get some harder evidence, I prefer to stay in.
But it's a very similar hard evidence there. You'll get rid of unelected foreigners telling you what to do.
Well, if you look at what the government says to us, if David Cameron, you know, tells us the truth,
unelected people at Westminster telling you what to do, the House of Lords.
I think you take the extreme view. I think you know, there is clearly some scope in this new agreement that you know, sovereignty is higher. There are more safeguards. You can you have a red card if you get 55% of the parliament saying, well, we don't like this. We don't have to commit to further political union.
We don't anyway.
But frankly speaking, we're in a joined up world. We do a lot of trade with Europe, and frankly, if Greece, Spain, Italy do go belly up, which probably they will do, I think we'll be affected anyway. So the question is, where is the best place to actually affect change? Is it from the outside, or is it from within? And I don't have an answer to that, I have to say. I just think the risks at the moment, I'm not convinced that they justify the, you know, the exit.
But isn't one of the problems of the EU, it was that, you know, we got in late there. It's basically Germany with a collection of second and third rate economic nations, and it should have been Britain, which is probably what Churchill was thinking of. Britain at the helm of a pan-European, with decent countries in there, Switzerland, Norway, the powerhouse countries. But it's just become like a benefits system for second and third rate countries. And the richer countries are paying for the poorer ones. So the structure is, you know, we were actually a basket case in the 70s when we came in. We went bust 2 years after. Yeah. We were Greece in the 70s. So we needed to be in the EU then because we needed that sort of bailout thing. Now we don't need a bailout, or not for the time being. So therefore, it doesn't serve our purpose anymore. Jim?
This is not an easy argument. There's nuances on both sides. But the way I would describe it is that, and I'm not trying to be boastful here, but in 2006, I wrote a book called Wake Up, which foretold of the coming crash and pointed to the US housing market as being the reason for the crash that's coming. And it's a book that you can buy. So in other words, I'm not making this up, all right? I now see a fire being set in the European Union. So if your house is on fire, do you stay in the house and wait to get burnt to death, which is what would happen if we stay in the European Union, or do you... You stay in the house because you're too frightened of what might lie outside the house. You know, there might be a robber outside, or there might be, you know, some animal that's going to eat you. Of course you're going to leave the house. And that's the choice that I think we're confronting today. This is not an argument, really, in my case, about sovereignty or immigration and so forth, all of which can, you know, valid arguments or benefits. And it's basically the house is going to be ablaze very soon. And I think it's better if, given the opportunity, that we should leave it.
So what about the migration situation? Because, I mean, that's something which is...
Well, I think we should... I like immigration. I mean, obviously you don't want any migrants, but I think immigration along the Australian lines, which is where you choose the people that you want to have in the country, those who are relatively young, who have skill sets that are required in this country, will help our country. But at the moment, we have to take all comers. We take anyone.
It's like anyone. It's like, you know, I don't see what the point of having a passport is.
Well, we have 3 million people in this country who can operate a Pret-a-Manger coffee machine. And that is not the basis of a technologically advanced society. We can't take in the Chinese entrepreneurs. We can't take in the Indian software engineers. We can't take in the Silicon Valley people because... we're already taking in too many migrants in the European Union, and the government has got to put this self-imposed sort of cap on.
300,000 people. I mean, that's
it's the size of Bristol every year.
So that, you know, that's a housing crisis, that's a schools crisis, and even worse, it's an NHS crisis. I mean, it's absolutely ridiculous, and nobody's saying anything about it at all.
Well, I think a lot of people are saying things about it, but
you never hear them.
Well, look, I mean, that is the groundswell of opinion at the local level that's going to vote to leave the European Union. Those are the people who will be voting to leave, the people who see the pressure on schools, hospitals, and so forth. And that's why it's a more finely balanced thing than the opinion polls, which are largely, and the bookmakers, largely suggesting that we're going to vote to remain. But I can tell you that there will be a game changer if there's a terrorist incident. I'm sure you agree with this. Terrorist incident in Europe between now and June. And it will also be a game changer if there's millions of migrants lined up to come into Europe in the early part of the summer. And so all bets, I think, are off at the moment. But my general tendency is we're going to vote to stay, sadly.
Yeah, Jim, right. In terms of immigration, don't you think that we need to use a sort of a pan-European solution to it? Because essentially you have all these migrants coming in into Europe from sort of Africa and the Middle East because of the political situation there. And obviously they're incentivized to come over to the West. Obviously they see a better opportunities and whatever in Europe. And in a way, Europe is a gateway almost to get to the UK. So I think unless there's some sort of pan-European solution to this, I really can't see it stopping. And my personal view is I think it's better to be in Europe. And obviously, I agree with a lot of the points you make. And in an ideal situation, I think if we could get back to almost a sort of a trade situation where we can trade freely with them. But unfortunately, I think, you know, so much time has passed that I think we're in a situation where we are here and it's very difficult to renegotiate and move back. So obviously I agree with a lot of your sentiments, and ideally I think Cameron should have got a much better deal for us from the EU. But, you know, frankly, I think the French and the Germans really don't want to give us very much, and they're not our best friends, frankly. So, you know, what do you think?
The Germans are good friends to the UK, and actually a lot of what Cameron got, in inverted commas, which is not very, it's a very thin gruel, the Germans are appreciative of because they want the same sort of thing. But Mrs. Merkel made a very big mistake by letting in 1.1 million people into Germany in the last year, and she's going to let another million in this year because the integration pressures in Germany are much, much greater than the 300,000 coming into this country. And I see it because I spend a lot of time in Berlin.
And isn't she trying to go for the same UK solution of trying to get the real estate prices up by getting in as many people as possible?
Well, that would suit me because my main assets in German real estate. But I take a more principled stand than just self-interest.
But people don't. That's the thing. Unfortunately, people are not going to do that, are they? They're going to go by the value of their house and the value of their wealth, their benefit, their benefits.
Yeah, if you give free food, free housing and free things, everyone's going to come.
It's bread and circuses, isn't it, from the EU?
But really, do you think that people come here because they're going to get benefits? I mean,
they come here just for money, yes.
No, I don't
and the people,
that.
I
think there's pretty good evidence that suggests that actually migrants from the EU actually pay more in taxes than they take out.
I think migrants from...
And I think, you know, Britain has built itself by actually taking in migrants. Okay, skilled ones like Huguenots in the 18th century, et cetera, et cetera. So I think fundamentally, I find it really wrong to actually scaremonger about people coming into this country. I mean, it's been one of the things that we have embraced. Now, clearly, you don't want to open the doors for everybody to come in. You need to be a little bit more controlled. Cool. And I think I agree with you that the policy that Australia has is actually much more sensible. But I think rather than it being just Britain, perhaps the EU could actually try and adopt a more sensible position, because all the EU countries need skilled, entrepreneurs, they need the scientists, doctors, etc. So rather than just have anybody who knocks on the door coming in, I think the EU should reflect and be more selective as well.
I just wanted to talk to Stephen Sarnason, chairman of UK Oil and Gas, about the North Sea, which I was trying to do about 20 minutes ago.
Yes, right,
Stephen, on the North Sea, it's unproductive now, or it's going into that way.
It's not unproductive. I mean, it still produces 800,000 barrels a day, which is over half of UK daily oil demand, which is about 1.4 million barrels a day. But it struggles
expensive.
At $30 a barrel.
Yes, exactly.
It struggles if not, doesn't make any money. It's primarily because, the fixed cost, the costs of actual operation are generally speaking, exceed, $30, and we're in a $32 oil price right now. So there's not going to be really at those, if prices, stay sort of below 50, 60, there can't really be any more real investment in any exploration, bringing on new fields on. And, the existing fields, their production declines through time. So, the cost per barrel increases with time. So, yeah, it doesn't look very good for the North Sea.
But it comes down to, we did save an industry, we saved the banking industry 7 or 8 years ago. Should we do the same, should we have the same bailout for the North Sea? Would that be a fair thing to do or a right thing to do?
Well, it depends how much the government and the country values energy security. Do you want indigenous oil and gas supply and the jobs that are related to it and the wealth creation value add to the economy? Or do you want to just simply pay somebody else for the oil and gas?
Because you don't want to have a situation where you had with the coal industry where, you had all the Thatchers and the mining strikes and all the other stuff like that. It becomes a horror story, and you become nationalisation. I mean, that sort of route of intervention, which hopefully we will be got rid of that now. But
I think people don't understand that the oil and gas industry on oil and gas derived revenues, you pay 30% corporation tax, which is 10% above what normal businesses pay, and then you pay another 20% on top of that. Now, people might argue when prices are $100 or $140 a barrel, well, then, the oil industry can afford it. But, oil prices are very cyclic. They go up and down. At the moment, they're down. The government, if it's really serious about, maintaining the 375,000 jobs that are related to the North Sea, might consider reducing, the tax burden on it. If the prices go up again, they can always increase the taxes. They do it very regularly. The tax rate on oil and gas goes up and down like a yo-yo in the UK anyway. But it's a question of what do they see the long-term position for indigenous oil and gas.
So if it was a level playing field on taxation, the North Sea wouldn't really have too much of a problem. Just being
no, it would still have a problem, because the fundamental point is that what it actually costs you, to produce a barrel of oil in the North Sea is actually very high. It's $30 a barrel in recent fields. It's probably higher. So, you wouldn't be paying any tax at the moment, essentially, because you're not making any profit. But people are not going to keep investing in the North Sea if they're not going to make any return on their investment. Why would they? It goes somewhere else.
Right. So, but are you sort of pro the not bucking the market or let nature take its course, rather than the intervention thing, even if it's an area of the oil sector is something dear to your heart?
I think the government could make a level playing field for all industry. Why is the oil and gas business singled out for extra harsh treatment?
It could be the banking sector where you're paid to fail. In the case of RBS, but just wanted to go on from that, obviously, to your speciality, which is the Weald Basin. That's a story that I've been aware of for the last 2-3 years. I think, depending on who you read or who you read, there was nothing there, or there was 100 billion barrels there. Presumably, it's between the two, and it's not the lower figure. That's what emerged very recently.
Depends what you mean by oil there.
Right, okay.
I think we made it very public that NewTek's study said that there's 124 billion barrels, actually oil, in the ground over the Weald area, which is about 1,200 square miles. That's not oil that you get out to the surface. That's oil in the ground. So there's a lot of oil in there, that's for sure. The question is, how much can you get out and can you make money from
So the cynics were saying you couldn't get even one drop of oil out of there. Hopefully you've already beaten those expectations.
Well, the cynics were misguided, shall we say.
Right.
But okay. I think we've shown that clearly we can get oil out at commercial rates. We don't know yet that we can get commercial quantities. We haven't been able to test it for long enough. But it looks very encouraging. You probably ask me, is it going to be another North Sea? Well, no, it's not. It can be very significant for the UK. It's not going to make us energy sufficient. It's probably 10-20% of daily oil demand, a few hundred thousand barrels. It could be if you extrapolate what we're doing over the Weald. But I think you have to understand that also this isn't going to really be, sort of 200,000 barrels for perhaps, 10 years' time. But by then, the North Sea is not going to be producing 800,000 barrels. It's going to be a lot smaller. So in terms of indigenous oil supply, the onshore, the Weald Basin could be, a very, very significant element of indigenous oil and gas supply and, a contributor, a significant contributor to the UK economy, jobs, et cetera, et cetera.
Stephen, do you have an idea of a sort of cost, of how much it's going to cost to get potentially get the oil out of the ground?
We were looking prior to the tests at sort of, $40 a barrel all in, including capital and operating costs, per barrel. With the results of the well, clearly the oil is coming out in much better rates than we ever imagined. So that would clearly improve the economics. I mean, the onshore development is much, much cheaper than offshore. I mean, the capital costs are much smaller and the operating costs are much smaller. Typical fields in the UK, I mean, some of the stuff we're involved in is only, sort of 10, 12 quid a barrel, $20 a barrel. So, that's pretty low. That's the attraction of onshore. Offshore is, you have to have huge capital expenditure to put big lumps of steel and concrete out there in order to be able to drill the wells and be able to produce it. You don't have to do that in the UK. You can get a small site, 4-6 acres, put all the wells below ground and pump away and no one knows it's there.
So essentially your rationale is that it's a lot technologically a lot easier to get this stuff out of the ground. Obviously the wheel.
Well, it's still a technological challenge. I mean, if it was that easy, someone would have done it by now. But, we're sort of at the, we're in the vanguard, shall we say. But the main issue on it is how much support the government wants to give to indigenous oil and gas supply. I mean, clearly, it makes sense. Governments are supposed to be, their prime role is to safeguard the nation. So, yes, you can say, well, okay, we have access to, you know, certain supply from certain areas in the world, that's fine. But the ultimate insecurity is that you have your own. But I think for me, the most important aspect is of having indigenous oil and gas, that it actually generates a lot of wealth for the country. It's a big gross value add to the economy. And, you know, with that, you get direct, indirect jobs from the supply chain, and you get a lot of induced jobs as well. So, you know, my point is, if you can't do it in the UK and you're an oil and gas man, you go do it somewhere else in the world, and they get the benefit. So why wouldn't we want the oil from the UK, and why wouldn't we want the benefits?
Right. The only sort of the fly in the ointment there, obviously, is the near-term outlook for price of crude. You know, as you said, it was around $32 a barrel. We've got Saudi Arabia, where I actually feel that they're bust and they just need to pump it out at any price. But I can't confirm that. But their original excuse was to put the frackers out of business, but they seem to be putting themselves out of business as well by over the last 18 months. Let's say we go back to $40 or $50 a barrel. Is that something that you can live with? And what's the sort of level? What's your outlook? And what can you live with as far as your business is concerned?
I'd like $50. Yeah. I'd really, you know, I dream $60 right now. But, you know, I think it's important to understand that at current prices, there's about four countries in the world that really make any money from their oil and gas production. And those are countries in the Persian Gulf, you know, Kuwait,
the Emirates.
Saudi. No, not so much the Emirates, right. But so, you know, they make money, but they clearly need money as well. I mean, the Saudi, to balance its books in 2015, needs a sort of oil price of about $106 a barrel. So, you know, it's getting a bigger hole in its pocket. So I think the war on, you know, U.S. shale oil as such wasn't as successful as they thought. There's a huge amount of, because it's basically the U.S. shale developments are essentially an industrial process. You get a lot of gains in reduction in costs and improvements in production. So the actual break even of those was thought to be, you know, $60, $70, $80 or so. It's sort of coming down to, you know, $40, $50 or so. And clearly a lot of the US tight oil production was heavily hedged. So there was a lot of, you know, financial support for it, which basically kept it going longer than Saudi thought. But That will tail off. The excess in the market was about almost 2 million barrels per day. Probably half of that came from U.S. shale. U.S. shale production is starting to go down quite significantly. You can see that by the number of wells that were permitted. In 2015, it was back down to levels of 2011. So in Texas, they permitted so we're like 5,500 wells in 2014. They were down to just over 2,000 in 2015, and it's dropping. So that sort of production drop will feed into the market, and the price will go up. When? Well, probably not. You know, not for a year or so, maybe even 18 months, and unless the Saudis really hurt. And you have to also understand that, you know, in OPEC, there are countries like Venezuela, Nigeria, Algeria, who basically are really hurting. I mean, the Venezuelans just, you know, they can't seem to get OPEC to cut production because they make almost zero money at these prices. So, you know, there may well be a war within OPEC as well. So we talked about wars within the EU, but could well be a war within OPEC.
Right. Just this is a question for both Jim and Harsha. Whoever wants to pick up on it first, feel free. But we had, you know, one of the worst Januaries, the worst starts to the year for the stock market in living memory. Is it easy to say now, as we approach the end of February, that the worst is over and it's just time to, you know, buy the dip and get on with life as normal? Harsha?
Well, I think that there's still a lot of uncertainty at the moment, obviously with Brexit, oil prices. There are other sort of political issues out there, but I think the important thing to remember, as Buffett has said, is that, you know, when you know people are fearful, it's time to be, you know, get in there and be greedy. So I think there are
obviously opportunities available, and I think this is a sort of stock picker's market, and I think it's important to be sensible, to think about, you know, look at the company, look at its fundamentals, how much debt does it have, is it generating cash flow, does it have any particular USP, any sort of moat where, you know, obviously brands are important. So I think when you're looking at the stock market, I think it's important obviously not to just, you know, panic and follow the herd. I think it's human instinct. People obviously get very nervous. They see, the bad headlines, and then, you know, but I think at that point you have to almost step back and look at the fundamentals of the companies and think, look, are there sort of investment opportunities here? Not just in the short term, but in the long term. So I think there are opportunities there, but I think one just has to be careful.
Yeah, but isn't there a problem? There's deflation. We've got the QE's run out of steam, and we've got zero rates or negative rates. The central bankers have run out of things to do now, and they can't even pretend they've got anything left. This time, it looks like it's different. It's not the dip to buy into. Jim?
The pernicious effects of negative and zero interest rates are the main cause of the financial malaise that we're in at the moment and the economic malaise. You can't get any savings, and therefore you can't get productivity growth in a country when you are effectively penalising and really ruining savings by pursuing these monetary policies. And so in those circumstances, one has to feel that there isn't a great deal of upside in stock markets generally. Another major plank which has been removed recently is the buyback in the United States of corporate of companies buying back their own shares and adding leverage to do so. And last year they bought about $600 billion worth of their own shares back, and that figure is falling dramatically, sort of 50% reduction this year and probably down to zero by the end of this year. That removes another plank. In a real bear market, it's such a grinding process and it's such a horrible process that it seems to go on forever, and valuations get to such ludicrous levels that you cannot hardly believe them, basically. I don't think we've reached that point yet. That having been said, for corporations to go on merger and acquisition, which is probably going to be the major catalyst to sustaining a stock market rally, the very low levels of interest rates are quite attractive on the other side of the coin. So you can borrow money extremely cheaply if you're a corporation, if you have the credit to do it. So in a nutshell, I completely agree with Harsha. This is a stock picker's market. If I had to forecast any movement in stock markets, I would say Japan is by far the best buy among developed markets. The United States remains a sell, in my opinion, overall. The UK, it's neither here nor there, although I would say that the UK market has gone nowhere since 1999 as measured by the FTSE 100, which is why I made the point the other day that FTSE 100 leaders coming out and lecturing us on Brexit, when at the same time they had been the same people lecturing us on joining the euro just 12 or 13 years ago and delivering a negative return over 17 years, these are not the kind of people that you want to listen to. You want to listen to true entrepreneurs who've built real businesses. And so those kind of Muppets coming out and telling us that we should vote for you to stay in, I give no credence to.
Jim, in terms of Japan, I'm aware that you've been sort of quite keen on it.
Recently, yeah.
Yeah. What makes you sort of, you know, so bullish? What are the particular factors there?
Well, I think it's, if you look at Western companies, the return on equity is considerably higher still than it is in Japan. But Japan is reforming itself, so that the opportunity for getting comparable return on equities in Japan, as with the West, is coming. Japanese companies are very under-leveraged. Japanese companies are making money hand over fist at the current exporting companies, the current level of the yen, and it's a big thing about which way the yen goes as well. But most importantly, Japan has the biggest pool of savings in the world, and those savings in Japanese government bonds are now earning negative rates, whereas on the stock market, the dividend yield is somewhere between 2 and 3%, which is very attractive to savers in Japan. So I feel that the Japanese market could go from the current level of, let's say, just around 17,000, the Nikkei, to 22,000 to 23,000 this year, which makes it a fairly attractive proposition, especially if the yen strengthens.
So you think there are these structural issues with the savers essentially looking for places to put their money, obviously putting it in the bank at a very poor deposit rates isn't very good. Is that
They don't get any deposit rate. Sure. They're getting a negative rate. And if you buy Japanese government bonds, they have a very flat yield curve at the moment. In other words, you're getting negative rates all across the spectrum of the bonds. That's a recipe, I think, for a stock market upsurge. Now, you have these negative rates elsewhere in the world, including in many European countries, but the situation is slightly different. You're paying relatively high earnings yields to buy into these companies. The drivers of their growth, emerging markets, buying, for instance, German manufacturers, are no longer as strong as they were. And so I don't think they're as attractive as the Japanese stock markets. As I said the other day, I back up a truck and buy Japan, wait for the next year, make some money on it, because it's hard to find really attractive situations. But I would say Japan is one. And I also think the health sciences area is very attractive just because of all the demographic factors. And my favorite company in that area is Gilead of the United States, which dominates the hepatitis C market, which is a very attractive market. You will note that David Bowie died of liver cancer, almost certainly induced by hepatitis C. Hepatitis C can now be cured by Gilead's drug. And, of course, HIV, which they dominate in, and they've got a very interesting oncology franchise. So that's my number one value stock at the moment. Very cash-generative company. And on the other side, I think Japan as a broad entity is a great buy.
Okay. Jim Mellon, Stephen Sanderson and Harsha Borralesa, thank you very much. With thanks to Jim Mellon, Stephen Sanderson and Harsha Borralesa, this has been The Collection. I'm Zach Meir.